If you are gregarious and want to celebrate your heritage, what better way than to have a food festival in your backyard? We talked to Gabriel Nurbas about his Bahia Pulpo y Pan Festival. It's on tip of the tongue. Welcome to Tip of the Tongue, a podcast on the Nitty Grits Network, where we explore the intersection of food and drink and museums. This is Liz Williams. We're here today with Gabriel Nurbas. Gabriel is a former Peace Corps volunteer in Togo, West Africa. He's half Spanish and half American, and he's a terrific cook. And he is the founder of the Paella Festival that he holds in his very large backyard, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Welcome, Gabriel.
Thank you, Liz. Happy to be here.
So tell me, how did you decide that we needed to have a Paella Festival in New Orleans? Because I will tell you, having attended the festival last year, which was the inaugural festival, right?
Correct.
I knew that this was something we needed. So how did this begin?
Yeah, we needed to have one because I longed for the rice dishes of my childhood and my young adulthood. And I longed for the bread that you can find so availably in Spain, and which you have to go to a couple choice bakeries here in New Orleans to find, which is awesome that they have it. But in Spain, it's criminal to pay more than a euro for a nice, delicious, freshly made loaf of bread. So I was trying to recreate that experience. Love gazpacho, love grilled fishes like octopus. And I just wanted to bring that here. And, you know, it is here. I found that a lot of the culture and heritage of Spain is in New Orleans. It's like tiny coals spread throughout the city that you just need to stoke a little bit. Because when I had that gathering, people who knew how to make paella came out of the woodworks.
There were lots and lots of people. And I could imagine other people were offering you things. Like when I said, I have a pan, that other people were just happy to say, use this. Yeah.
Oh yeah. My next door neighbor would never expect this. Had a huge thing of azafrán, saffron.
Oh.
I mean, a massive container. And it was fresh and it was delicious. I had a number of people suggest that they share pans, and a number of people who had plenty of suggestions when we were cooking about how it's really done. I was like, okay, that's your opinion. And that's fine. That's their family and their tradition.
Sure,
it's kind of like trying to tell another New Orleanian how to make red beans.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, of course. But that is the joy of it, that you make it your way, I make it my way. We recognize it's the same thing. It's part of the culture, but each one's is individual. I mean, that means it's really a deep part of the culture when it can be individual and universal at the same time.
Liz, there's one more reason I decided to have this gathering. And all the culinary reasons are there. I moved to New Orleans from Costa Rica in 2014 after a career as a humanitarian aid worker with stints in East Africa and West Africa, Latin America, and Indonesia. And I was looking for a place where all wealth classes could get together over a meal. And initially when I got here, I was like, okay, you know, there's this wonderful network of people, there's this great club, but I didn't see that interaction where the poorest of the poor were there and the wealthiest and most powerful were there. And I thought, let's just drop all the titles. Let's have a meal together. Let's have some vino tinto and some music. And let's just be brothers and sisters. And that was a big reason for why I held this. I thought that nothing breaks down class boundaries like a good meal.
Well, that's true. It's been true forever. That's why we have all kinds of diplomacy over the table, and it's a way to welcome strangers always. Yeah. So Let's talk about some specifics here. You know, it's definitely true that when before the sale of Louisiana to Jefferson, to Thomas Jefferson, the Louisiana Purchase, if you look at the founding of the city by the French and then the French ceding it to Spain, the Spanish actually were in charge of New Orleans for longer than the French, but the Spanish government has not spent as much time establishing the Spanishness of the city the way the French have. And why do you think that is? Do you think that it just wasn't that important? Or, I mean, there's a sense
I think.
I feel that when the Spanish were here, they didn't find it the colony as important as, say, Texas, Mexico, because we weren't producing money. You know, we didn't have silver, we didn't have vanilla or chocolate or any of those things.
It's possible that it had less political importance and less resource importance for the empire. I also think that Spain has a history of integrating in societies that, I mean, there's plenty of carnage and negative history that is true. And the Spaniards were the ones who would intermarry and not have such obscene racist laws about who could be an heir and who wasn't an heir. I don't think the Spaniards care as much to put out a diplomatic voice about the good things they do. They just kind of integrate and do. And the French do a really good job in self-promotion. You know, I have French blood, so I'm not here to dog France. I love France, and I love French heritage and French cooking. And you know, there's a reason that the rest of the French Empire at one point was calling, you know, France the Lumière, the Soleil. They do a really good job, and they have done, and they should cast light on the heritage. And I think currently Spain is in a process of not emphasizing the heritage worldwide, but encouraging, hey, you know, let's stoke these coals that are everywhere throughout the world, and just kind of highlight the partnership that is now and the sisterhood that existed over decades. So I know that Spain, when Galvez was governor for 8 years, a Spanish governor, many people don't know that he was instrumental, and Spain was instrumental in supplying the American rebels with armaments by allowing those to go through port of the Mississippi River in New Orleans to go inland. Early on, those armaments that went to the rebels in the Midwest were really crucial for the initial stages of the war.
You're talking about the American Revolution
Correct. The
there?
American Revolution. Yep.
Okay. Well, so let's get back to the Paella Festival. You and I could talk for hours about the influence of the Spanish in terms of the food of New Orleans and its cuisine and its development and everything. But one of the things that I think is so funny is that when the Spanish came, they decided that the what we now call the French Market needed to actually have a roof, and that it needed to be clean and things like that, which the French didn't worry about. You know, they just needed to build an opera house. They didn't need a sewer system, and so they knew what was important to them. And I think that the Spanish came in and they sort of laid down some order over what used to be just kind of a free-for-all. And I think that it established something with the culture of the city that we do live in the free-for-all. We're quite comfortable there. So, but let's talk about your experience here with the Paella Festival. So tell us what you did first. How did you establish it? What did you do?
It all centered on the paellera, which is the wide flat pan that one would cook rice dishes in Spain, and specifically paella. That's why it's its namesake. I had a paellera that a friend of mine asked me to cook paella for his daughter's engagement party in Mandeville on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain. And I did it there for a crowd of, I don't know how many people there were, maybe 100, 200 people. And I did it with success over an open fire, which is the traditional way to do it. And after having done that, I thought I would love to do this one day when I have a yard myself. And my wife and I had moved from uptown New Orleans, beautiful little place. We loved it. But it didn't have the space to have an outdoor fire. If we set a fire, we probably would have caught the house on fire. So, it's a 1 meter pan in diameter. So you need a spread on the coals. But yeah, I mean, eventually I was just like, I have this space. I have this desire to gather people who can just take interest in one another at a level of depth, which I normally long for. I'm not a big football person. I'm not a big hunting person. So relating and finding what interests other people and then taking those topics and, going on journeys together, that's just exciting to me. And so I wanted to create that. And so, yeah, the paella was step one. And I just started inviting friends. And then I was like, you know what? This is going to be a night also of octopus, which is one of my favorite seafood. So I thought, okay, we'll make it a party of paella, pulpo, and pan. All three are peas. It's kind of rolled off the tongue. Pan is bread. And I have a very strong passion for making artisanal loaves and what are called in the United States baguettes, but in Spain are just called bars of bread, barras de pan. So I thought, okay, those three go really well together: paella, some octopus, and then some bread. And then, of course, we had gazpacho. And once you see, like, okay, this is the foundation. Well, what else is missing? And then I plugged the gaps, and yeah, I invited friends. I'm a member of a network here in New Orleans of Spanish descendants called La Sociedad Española. Through the Sociedad, I met the Consul General of Spain, who's the representative of Spain to the U.S. in New Orleans. And let's see. I mean, from there, I'm in the Hispanic Chamber. I hit all the Spanish-speaking networks I could imagine, and then I tried to figure out which nonprofits work with underprivileged Hispanic children. And then I targeted them and I said, I want your employees to come. And then I went to Tulane University, Loyola University. I invited their modern languages departments. I learned about the work you do at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I invited Poppy Tooker from Louisiana Eats. It just started spreading because at the end of the day, I thought, look, one thing I learned in West Africa as a Peace Corps volunteer, one of my favorite things is where seven can eat, so can eight, or eight can eat, so can nine. And that just keeps going. So I figured, just make the invitation, gather the people, and we'll figure out the food. And I'll tell you what, we had loaves of bread I had to give away at the end. Even though people were tearing it up at the beginning, I still at the end had like three loaves to give away. So we didn't run out of food. We didn't run out of rice. I had rice to give away. We ran out of octopus.
Yeah, well, that's no surprise. Yeah, that's pretty good. So tell me now, this year you're adding an oven for the bread. So
Yes.
tell us what's happening there, because it's getting close to the date of the actual festival.
Yeah, I'm gonna be working. I'm gonna have a night light in my yard, laying bricks. Yeah, so the oven. My great grandmother was from Úbeda, and actually my grandmother as well grew up in Úbeda. It's a town about 45 minutes an hour from Granada. If you're familiar with Andalusia in southern Spain, it's a 5 hour drive from Madrid, about 40 minutes from the Mediterranean coast. That's Granada. And then, so Úbeda is where my grandmother's from. And her family were bakers. They were bakers and they had firewood ovens. And if you know Spanish history, the 1930s, specifically 1936 to 39, there was a civil war in which the Spaniards killed, I think, a half a million of their own people against internally within a village, people killing each other there, within cities killing each other. It's a very gruesome chapter of history in Spain and a tremendous transition from the old feudal system that a lot of the country lived under, were seasonal migrant workers, and the wealth was super concentrated in a few aristocratic class. And anyway, the transition to democracy didn't go great. Let's just put it there. And then obviously the fascists won out. But anyway, back to the 30s. My grandmother made it through the war without hunger because her family, as bakers, were able to trade flour and sugar and other for food. So she didn't pass hunger, and her family was on the left side. My grandfather, in contrast, is from the same region, but they did pass hunger. His dad was a chief of police, and so he was on the right side. They ended up losing that the left side took over in his particular region, so they retreated to the mountains of Cazorla, which actually, funny enough, oversee Úbeda, which is where my grandmother was, living comfortably. I mean, it was a war, so I don't want to make it sound like it was a great thing, which they weren't starving, whereas my grandfather had to have food airdropped to him from the age of 3 to 6 on the side of a mountain, and did suffer tremendous hunger with his mother in particular. And so that's the heritage of where the bread begins. Is it's for me, it's nourishment that can get people through anything. And I love baking, and I love firewood, and I've been just been longing to produce bread in greater quantities. Anytime I make bread, I don't make one loaf. I make usually six, and then I go, all right, I'm gonna go bring one to my mom. I'm gonna go bring one to my younger brother and my sister-in-law. Now I have a little nephew there, so I love sending the bread there. And then, which friends do I want to bring it to today, this moment? I think of them and I bring them the loaves. But I've longed to do this at scale, and I thought, what better than a proper Andalusian oven that can pump out, tens of loaves at a time at a 700 to 1,000 degree temp.
So, do you have a long-handled peel that you can put
I
things in?
do.
You do? Okay.
Underneath the house right now.
So, all right. So, this year there's going to be freshly baked bread and
Correct.
freshly made paella en polvo. So then, what are you? I know it hasn't happened yet because this is going to be number two, and it hasn't happened, but. Does that mean that there's going to be some new improvement for the following year?
Oh, I'm certain there will be. Right now, I'm just eager to get the foundation poured. There were a lot of storms this past weekend, so we were supposed to pour the foundation on Saturday. But I'm really hyper focused on building this oven brick by brick. And so that's my main priority right now. I'm certain next year, maybe I'll build out the dessert a little bit more. This year, I've asked people to bring some desserts if they would like. People are asking me, what can I bring? What can I bring? I said, okay, well, you don't have to bring anything. But if you want to bring something, bring a bottle of good Spanish wine, or bring a dessert, or my what I would rather is you consider somebody in your network who is lonely and invite them. So that's my desire. But I do want to tell you, my younger sister, Emma, so this past weekend, she flew to Spain to stay with my family. And I just asked her, I'm like, hey, while you're there, do you mind grabbing me some azulejos, which are tiles from the south that are typical of Úbeda, because I want to pay homage to my family's bakery, and then typical to Granada, where the rest of my Spanish family lives. And she's actually stopping by a couple of the bakeries that are still in existence that are firewood bakeries. Most of these firewood bakeries have died off in the transition of Spain to a modern economy. That most bakeries have transitioned from firewood to electric stoves. And then the kids aren't as interested as continuing the bakeries. So then, they lose them. But there are a couple that are holdouts, and I've identified them because I'm doing a lot of research to do the stove the way, the oven the way I think should be done for my yard. And so I reached out to Úbeda. There's a cultural center called the Hospital de Santiago, and they just so happen to have the 2022 International Bread Festival.
Oh
So they
my.
had a ton of resources for me to get plugged into. And so I've been talking to bakers and people in southern Spain who are interested in helping develop this concept.
So, do you think that your sister can get you a piece of the dough that she can send over that you can use to put into your bread so that you can bring that over to America?
You mean like a yeast strand? You mean like a
Well,
yeast?
yeah, just how you save a little bit of the dough for the
Yeah,
next
yeah, yeah.
time,
Yeah, that would be like a sourdough
Yeah,
starter. I
sort
mean,
of.
you know
Yeah.
what? That's a great idea, Liz, and she's still there. I gotta just check to see what U.S. Customs and Border Control would have to say about a
Right.
live culture passing through, but hey, they might be cool with
Well, they might even be able to dry some of
it.
it, and then it would probably be able to come in because you can buy now dried sourdough starter. So you don't have to keep the starter. You can just buy it already dried. I mean, like, I'm never going to be a sourdough person and have this culture on
You
my.
and I relate because I'm not a sourdough person myself.
But I like the slight, I don't have to have like San Francisco sour kind of bread, but I do think that the bread has a better flavor and it does better with its holes and everything inside when you use a sourdough starter. You just don't have to have one that makes you
Thingy.
feel like they put lemon peel in it or something.
Right.
And so I like using, instead of just buying regular yeast, I like using the sourdough starter that you can just buy now. And so that's so they dry, and all they do is dry it. And so I don't see why you couldn't get a little bit of dried sourdough or
Consider
just.
it done, Liz. As soon as this podcast is over, I'm gonna call my sister on WhatsApp and get it done.
So let's talk a little bit about how you learned to cook.
Okay.
So how did this happen?
I think my cooking started in the garden. So I'll give first credit to my mother, who taught me the importance of creating by cooperating with nature. And so, we had our little radish garden with little radish and lettuce in uptown New Orleans on a concrete slab with a raised, garden bed. And I loved it and I tended that thing methodically. But my mom really kind of planted that joy in my heart. And then my grandmother, actually my US grandmother she's from New Orleans, but she, when I was born, she lived in Carencro outside of Lafayette in a swamp house. She was an architect, and so was her husband. She was actually the first woman architect and the only woman in her class at LSU when she went through at Louisiana State University. But in any event, she had beautiful vegetable gardens. And so she taught me, I guess, the complexity of how it works together. And I just love pulling carrots. I love pulling strawberries. She always had something. Satsumas, she had orchards, and it was really not. I mean, I'm telling you, she lived backing up to a cypress swamp, and she had these beautiful gardens that flowed into a forest. So the forest would turn into an orchard, and the orchard would turn into her, fenced-in garden to keep the armadillos out. And within her garden, she had geometric boxes. That's why I have geometrically shaped boxes in my backyard. So she taught me about the base ingredients. But then it was really my uncle Juan Toral Malo, who married my blood aunt Adela. He was, so in Spain, you have to go into military service for a couple years. This was the case until I was 16, thankfully, because otherwise I would have had to renounce my Spanish citizenship, because the US isn't going to be okay with me being in a foreign military.
Right.
He used to have to do a 2-year stint with the military, and his 2-year stint was to be a chef for the
Oh,
military. Yeah.
okay.
So he taught me how to cook, how to cut, how to slice, how to chop swiftly and safely. He taught me all the hand techniques. I mean, I don't know how old I was, maybe 11 and 12, and I spent summers with them. Every summer growing up, almost of my childhood, I was in Spain with family. just eating, enjoying, and then learning. And he also taught me how to make a lot of tapas at once. So tapas, just small dishes. You know, it's not, you don't just make one tapa. Typically you have like seven or eight, you know. So he taught me how to do that and to cook efficiently and quickly different things, and how to manage the different areas of heat. And then my Aunt Maria del Mar, she really gave me the foundation of how to cook with complexity and without a recipe. So she would teach me the, you know, how do you make a gazpacho? How do you make a guiso, a soup? How do you make a salmorejo? By, and you know, how do you cut the potatoes for tortilla de patatas? You know, she made a big deal about certain things, which my brother claims makes no difference. Like, you know, she was always like, cut the potatoes irregularly. It makes it taste better. And my brother's like, doesn't matter, just slice it like this, you know. But she gave me a real affinity for knowing how to taste things and then add without needing to measure everything. Now, in baking, I'm a bit of a, I've got a mania. I've got a serious focus on exactness in the baking. But in the cooking on the stove, cooking on the fire, she taught me. And I spent years with her learning in the summers. And then I lived with her in 2003 and 2004 when my uncle, her husband, was dying of brain cancer, unfortunately, at a very young age. He was in his 30s. She's a pretty young aunt for me. But she would every day at lunch cook the most delicious meal because she didn't know how much longer he was going to be with her. So every day was going to be a present, loving meal together. And she lived one day at a time like that. And he ended up living, I don't know, on chemo and three open brain surgeries over an 8-year period.
Oh,
But she
wow.
cooked like that incredibly well. My grandfather was the third person I really learned from. And now he was tougher because he really was fascist. I'm just going to put that out there. That's just the reality. And what's tough about that is there's so much order and kind of just not respect for others' opinions, especially if you're a younger person. However, he's my grandfather, so I long to learn how to cook from him. He, as a young adult and then a young father, had a job working for a German consulting company that's role was to improve hotel ratings all over Spain. So hotels would hire him and he'd deploy for 3 months, 6 months, a year. And he told me the fastest way to improve a hotel rating is to go to the kitchen first. Because, you know, these hotels, it wasn't like nowadays where you have, you know, a hotel that's just going to put a continental breakfast. They have a proper restaurant in each of these. He said, you sort out the logistics in the hotel kitchen, then everything falls out into place. And so, you know, I learned about shelf life. And but he, look, from that experience, he went to Galicia, he went to Catalonia, he went to Cáceres, he went to Andalusia. Every place he went, he did something that was also something you can only really get away with in fascist times. He told the chef at each hotel he went to, I don't care if it's on the menu. I want your best family recipe and I want you to show me how to make it. So, you know, that's a really mean way of extracting information, but it worked. And then he taught me tons of these dishes. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a broken history there. But look, at the same time, I'm keeping things alive that are really incredible meals that,
And
you know,
I want to know how you're instilling this in your own children. Are they cooking with you? Do they cook with
Are you
you?
kidding me? Are you kidding me? They love to cook. See, for me, for them, they see what we can create together. They love to garden too, you know. So I'm bringing what my mother brought to me, what my grandmother brought to me, and then obviously what my Spanish family. They help me with almost every meal. Like I'll make pancakes from scratch. They're mixing the ingredients. I let them pour it. You know, we're making arroz con pollo on the grill outside. You know, they're tossing in the ingredients and making the sofrito. I let them pour in the wine. That's a big deal to reduce. And they love making bread. They love making bread with me. So I don't
Okay.
know. That's the way I share my love with my kids, is
Yeah.
we create together.
Yeah, and then they love eating it and they want to share with others, and that's a wonderful thing. Yeah.
Yeah, they love eating it. It's funny, they'll tell their friends, like they'll get asked at school, "What's your favorite meal?" Like whatever, and they'll say something like, "What is it? Bouillabaisse in France?"
Yeah.
Or they'll say, "Mussels. I love mussels," and it's just a Spanish dish with white wine and garlic and.
Yes, I like a little bit of absinthe in mine. I think it
Ooh, I'll
takes
have to try that.
that slight little, a lot of times you could throw fennel in and kind of give it that flavor, but I just put in with the wine, I put it like, a splash of absinthe.
I'm gonna do that.
It really is good.
But I want to tell you, I have three precious girls, 2, 6, and 8 years old. And if I want the boy, I think we're gonna have to adopt a boy, which both my wife and I are very open to. So we'll see where that goes. Maybe I'll teach that
Yeah,
boy
of course you will. Yeah.
how to cook too. 100%.
Yes. So, Gabrielle, thanks so much. This has been a great conversation, and I know that this year's Paella Festival will be better than the one last year, even though the one last year was wonderful. And I am looking forward to annual Paella festivals and seeing how they evolve over time.
Thank you so much, Liz. I'm excited as well.
Thanks for listening to Tip of the Tongue, a part of the Nitty Grits Network of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Subscribe to this and other food and drink related podcasts at southernfood.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to keep up with me, Liz Williams, you can subscribe to my Substack newsletter, also called Tip of the Tongue, for more information about this podcast, recipes, and just what is going on. I'm Liz Williams. Thanks for listening.